Downtown Broadcast Center. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Hong Kong police told protesters they could gather for a rally at Victoria Park on Sunday, but they weren't allowed to march to the Central District. They marched anyway. Our own senior producer was there. She's from Hong Kong, and she's joining us next, right here on KPCC. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman. Larry Mantle caught a summer bug, so he is taking it easy and recovering today. Get well soon, Larry. On Sunday, the streets of Hong Kong were filled once again by a sea of protesters demanding government reforms and greater independence from Beijing. The Sunday march was one of the largest shows of solidarity by demonstrators. It was the 11th week in a row of this type of protest. Recently, it had included violent clashes between protesters and police. A member of our Air Talk team was right there for this major Sunday demonstration on the ground in Hong Kong. Senior producer Fiona Ng, born and raised in Hong Kong, and she's visiting there now. Hi, Fiona. Where were you on Sunday, and what did you see?
Since early in the morning, people were prepping to hit this rally in Victoria Park. And there's been a lot of promotion and advertisement online. And also you see signs pretty much in a lot of different places in Hong Kong telling people to get out and join this rally. And, you know, I was at Victoria Park at about 1:30 p.m. The rally was due to start at 2:00. And I was just there watching as the fields get packed with people. So it was supposed to start right at 2:00, but because of the crowd that was getting in, they had to delay it by until 2:45 or whatever. But the point that the organizers wanted to do was to basically to pack as many people as possible into this space. And we're talking about six football size, and football meaning soccer fields, plus this lawn area that surrounds these fields. So pack it as much as they can so that they can basically force the hands of the police and the government to block the roads when they get people out of the rally. So I saw a lot of people, old, young, you know, I saw a couple of toddlers. And, you know, what was amazing was it was really, really peaceful.
So there have been in recent weeks some violent clashes between protesters and police, particularly at the Hong Kong airport. Those images were all over the news in the past week or so. But when you were out at this protest across Hong Kong, you saw mostly a peaceful demonstration. Am I right?
That is correct. It was really peaceful the whole way. You know, it lasted, I would say, 6, 7, 8 hours. By the time that I crossed the finish line in Central, it was 9 p.m. for me. I went home afterwards, but I was then monitoring what was going on these social media groups that are put up by protesters. And what I was really seeing was a little bit concerning to me. There were a small group of protesters, maybe 1,000 people. They decided to basically loiter and surround the government headquarters in a place called Admiralty, which is just right before the end of the crossing line in Central. And that standoff kind of held for about 2-3 hours. And as I was watching, I was really afraid that violence was going to break out. And that was what was interesting to me as I was watching what was happening online. A lot of these protests and most of the communication about these protests happened in these chat rooms. And we're talking about in places like Telegram or WhatsApp. And I can really see that the conversation that was happening was that they really wanted this to be a peaceful protest. There were people in that chat room that were getting the word out to get the people on the streets in front of the government building to leave. And it took 2 hours for them to be convinced to do that.
So the vast majority of protesters are asking for this to be peaceful, but there is a small knot of hardliners who are pushing the envelope is what you're seeing.
You're absolutely right. And you see that play out pretty much, that tension between a peaceful protest and people who are a little bit more aggressive on you know, pretty much every time there's a protest. And there's actually names for these factions of people. And one is called, you know what, I'm not going to go there. You know, I'm just going to end with their names for these factions, two factions of people. And, you know, it's really interesting to see how this is going to play out between the peaceful protesters and also those who wanted more direct action in forcing the government to do something.
What are the people saying, Fiona, people in the streets? What are you hearing from folks? Why are they taking to the streets? Because it was such a large number, over a million, 1.7 million was what the organizers claimed. The police said that that was an overcount. What are you hearing from people?
Yeah, and the police and the government is saying that it's 120,000 people. Now, I'm not really sure if it really was 1.7 million. It was a lot of people, but it was definitely more than 120,000 people. And you know what? I was talking to different people at the rally and about why they were coming out. And their sentiment was that, you know, they really wanted the government to start a dialogue with the protesters in the city about the five demands that they have, which include a total withdrawal of the extradition bill, which would basically send fugitives to China. And also the people wanted a independent commission to examine police brutality. And then they also call for direct election. And right now the city's leader is not voted in by one person, one vote. So that's what they wanted. But people really thought that after what happened at the airport, there needs to be, I feel like, a little bit of a reset. What happened that was building up to this weekend was, as you said, a lot of escalation in violence. We were seeing, yes, as far as I'm concerned, when I was in the U.S., watching kind of news of police shooting off tear gas and protesters throwing bricks at the police. So that was really ramping up. But this time, you know, what struck me about this weekend was that all the protests that I've been to, including the one in Victoria Park, have been peaceful. And there was one on Friday. There were two or three on Saturday, and the big one, accumulating the big one on Sunday. So that's the sense that I got. People wanted a dialogue, and they thought that a show in number would basically get the Hong Kong government to listen.
We're talking with Air Talk senior producer Fiona Ng, our fearless leader usually here at the show, and she is actually in Hong Kong right now because she's a Hong Kong native. She grew up there, she worked there, and she is visiting and observing the protests that have been ongoing for 11 weeks now in Hong Kong, protesters asking for more independence from China. Fiona, as somebody who was born there, who has family there still, how do you feel seeing so many people take to the streets and express their political voices?
It was really moving. It really was to see all those people showed up. And it was really difficult to do a day of protest in that sense. You know, we started off at 2 p.m. and then it went all the way to about 9 or 10. There were just so many people on the streets that it took me 4 hours to walk to the end of the march, which was central, what would have taken me maybe an hour. So it was physically demanding. It was pouring rain. The rain never stopped. But it was so orderly. And to see that people were just really coming together to there was no complaints. If anything, what I heard a lot was while I was walking with all these people, where they were talking about, hey, man, where do you want to get dinner after this? So it was just kind of like a lovely thing that to witness. But
like a social event, like people are kind of hanging out, they're marching, and then they're going to go and, you know, have a drink afterwards.
Yeah, or that, you know, this is just something that they have decided to do on their Sunday night. And, you know, there have been a lot of protests planned basically every week, every big weekend, if not like 3-4 times a week, that I feel like people are understanding the importance of having their voices heard. And this is the way to do it. It really is lovely. But, you know, at the same time, I don't really feel like the government, you know, is likely to budge. You know, for the last 3-4 weeks, with the escalation of violence, what the government has said and its chief executive, Carrie Lam, has said is that they are not, you know, they have basically responded to these demands, and is that it's not going to happen. So,
and the government in Beijing has also been moving troops into Shenzhen across the river from Hong Kong. The New York Times has been reporting on the People's Armed Police doing drills nearby and moving in a lot of equipment. Are protesters that you talk to there scared about Beijing moving in a paramilitary force to try to address the protests?
Yeah, and while I was in Hong Kong, I did see the video of that being broadcast on the news. So the people that I've talked to, and this is, you know, not indicative of 7 million people for sure, but what I'm hearing is that, you know, they don't really feel like it's going to happen. They feel like it's an empty bluff because of the economic kind of position of Hong Kong. And a lot of people that I've talked to think that what's unique about Hong Kong and what they're trying to preserve really is a kind of, is this independent judiciary system and also its rule of law, which really gives international businesses a confidence to invest in China through Hong Kong. If the people's People's Liberation Police or the Chinese police were to come in and come through the border, they feel like, you know, Hong Kong will immediately lose that cachet. So it's actually not going to help Hong Kong. It's also not going to help China.
That's AirTalk senior producer Fiona Ng. She was at the protest in Victoria Park and throughout Hong Kong yesterday. Fiona, thank you so much for joining us today on the show, and be safe out there.
Will do. Thank you so much, Libby. I'll see you pretty soon.
Also on the line is Ray Zong, Program Associate for the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center, a Washington-based nonpartisan policy forum that tackles global issues through independent research. And Ray, you're listening to Fiona there in Hong Kong, seeing her hometown being taken over really by this struggle between protesters and police. What is the political context here? What does it mean that Hong Kong is a semi-autonomous territory?
Well, it essentially goes back to the political agreement that China and the UK agreed to during the handover in the 90s, in which there would be something called sort of one country, two systems that persisted until 50 years after the handover, so 2047. But in recent years, certain moves within Hong Kong's government has been concerning to the general public, so that has included giving the CCP more leverage over which types of political candidates can be chosen for Hong Kong leadership. You've also had the increasing economic and political pressure from the mainland more broadly. And this has culminated in a lot of anxiety over is one country, two systems sort of heading towards Hong Kong turning into just about every other Chinese city at a much faster pace than anticipated.
So this is so much broader than the extradition agreement that initially sparked these protests a couple months ago.
Well, the extradition bill in particular is of concern, not just because of what's happening in Hong Kong, but also due to how law enforcement has changed in the Chinese mainland. There's been a lot of stories about quite high-profile criminal cases, including the former director of Interpol, just simply going missing. And these defendants they're not being charged and processed within a system that has a transparent process. And that's all information that Hong Kongers are seeing, and they're worried that this is going to be the law enforcement system that's also going to be in place for Hong Kong as well.
I'm speaking with Ray Zong, Program Associate for the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. And because you look at relations between the U.S. and China, Ray, I'm wanting to hear your take on what does this mean for a democracy like the U.S. that values free speech to be watching what's happening in China, in Hong Kong, with China really pressuring the police in Hong Kong to crack down on that speech. How does the U.S. relate and show support of these protesters without destroying its relationship with Beijing?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that Beijing, the way that Beijing is processing the narrative of protests, it's not this. It's processing it in a way that is framing protesters as being influenced by sources of foreign influence, specifically from the United States. So it's a very delicate question for Americans as well. How does this protest does this protest teach anything to America? But also, how is this protest uniquely about Hong Kong? Something that also hits much closer to home is we've also seen in Canada and Australia people holding solidarity demonstrations with Hong Kong. And then at these solidarity demonstrations, groups of nationalistic Chinese demonstrators, they're showing up, they're tearing down sticky notes, they're being confrontational against pro-Hong Kong protesters. So I think these overseas demonstrations will have the most direct question of what will American policymakers do?
What's next? You see these people's liberation. It's the People's Armed Police that have gathered across the river, not the People's Liberation Army. And they're running drills. It's a clear show of force right across from Hong Kong. Is there an expectation that China will step up and actually send personnel in that are uniformed troops? Or is this something that right now appears to just be an intimidation factor from China?
I think that China is most likely going to continue to rely on Hong Kong law enforcement to tamp down on protests until that proves ineffective at some point in the future. For Hong Kong's part, this is added to requests for inquiry into police conduct. But as of right now, I haven't seen any indications that there's going to be a drastic change in it. Most of the action by the Chinese government has been on propaganda and public opinion. It's really poured a lot of resources into pro-China content production, so video, multimedia content, internet memes, celebrity endorsements. There's a lot of public opinion management and propaganda work done right now to influence how the domestic Chinese public is seeing Hong Kong and convincing them to go to bat for China's national interests.
Well, I think the U.S. domestic public could attest that internet memes have a lot of power when it comes to public opinion and even political action. We've seen this in recent years here. I'm speaking with Ray Zong of the Kissinger Institute at the Wilson Center. Final thought, Ray, on what is next. Are there any indications that China will budge on any of the demands of the protesters?
As of right now, I don't think there are any indications that this is something that China will budge on. China's, in general, has not budged easily on any of its peripheral interests. And I think that as time passed, it's only sort of doubled down on previously held positions.
Ray Zong with the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. Thanks very much for being on Air Talk.
No problem. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to have our weekly political panel tackle what the president has said recently about Hong Kong and those protests. And also, is the economy still President Trump's strong suit going into the 2020 election? We'll tackle it all in just a minute here after this short break on Air Talk. Back now with Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Larry's recovering from a little bit of a summer bug. Thanks for sticking with us while Larry is away. We're going to stay with Hong Kong as we welcome our politics panel to the mix here on Air Talk. Lonnie Chen is with us, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He was an advisor for Marco Rubio's 2016 presidential campaign and served as policy director for the Romney-Ryan 2012 presidential campaign. Lonnie, thanks again. Always love talking with you on Air Talk.
Hi, Libby. Good to be with you.
So I want to get your reaction first to what's going on in Hong Kong, and we'll play a little audio of what the president said yesterday. It's tarmac audio outside of a plane in New Jersey, so stick with us on this. But he's responding to the idea of China cracking down on Hong Kong protests having an effect on trade negotiations between the U.S. and China.
No, I think it would be very hard to deal if they do violence. I mean, if it's another Tiananmen Square, I think it's a very hard thing to do if there's violence. And, you know, that I'm president, but that's a little beyond me because I think there'd be, you know, I think there'd be tremendous political sentiment not to do something.
Lonnie, prior to this, the president had mostly steered clear or praised Chinese President Xi Jinping. What's the role of a U.S. president in this situation, and what do you make of how Trump is handling this?
Well, the president, you know, he sort of put himself in a challenging position here because on the one hand, he's got this trade negotiation with the Chinese, which has carried on much longer, I think, than people would have liked and expected. It's created a tremendous amount of uncertainty for the economy, and he's trying to bring that to some kind of resolution. But it is, I mean, it may be the understatement of the century to say that if the government of China were to engage in a more violent repression of what's happening in Hong Kong, it would create a complication for the trade talks. I mean, that much is obvious. The question really becomes, how forceful does the U.S. want to be in speaking on behalf of those who are fighting for freedom and democracy in Hong Kong? And traditionally, it's been the role of the American president to stand firmly on the side of those who are seeking freedom and liberty. So he's got a difficult situation because there's no question that President Xi of China would not appreciate President Trump being more vocal in his support. Yet I think at some level, an American president has to speak out for those values and has to stand for the things that the protesters are by and large standing for in Hong Kong.
Nomiki Konst is with us as well, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission, which worked to increase participation in the Democratic Party and reform the presidential primary process. She's also a former Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016. Nomiki, thanks for being on Air Talk. And you heard the president talking about the idea of another Tiananmen Square happening in Hong Kong. Republicans, Democrats, members of Congress from both sides of the aisle have supported these protests very vocally. Does it surprise you to hear the president kind of tiptoeing around this issue?
Well, I think it surprises me as an American who's witnessed him crack down on protesters, whether it's Standing Rock with force or free speech or against journalists. So the values, I don't think he's necessarily standing up for the values as maybe other American lawmakers are doing so. I think what concerned me in that clip that you just played was there was almost a slight veiled threat against China that we'll have to do something. Well, what does that mean? Are you going to go to war with China? Seriously, I mean, we're dealing with a president who is all over the place with his foreign policy, with his thoughts on supporting free speech. And as Lonnie just said, you know, this is sensitive because of the trade negotiations. And it seems like everything comes from a place of, can he make a deal? All of his decisions and his thoughts. But what really concerns me is, was that a threat? And can you imagine how another leader of one of the three superpowers takes that? Is that a military threat? I don't know. I mean, this is the world that we're living in today. We don't know.
The language is imprecise.
Yes.
As usual, a lot of it kind of comes out, you know, as a word salad. And it's difficult to kind of, you know, track exactly what is that, a serious comment or is that something that's kind of off the cuff? Do you think, Nomiki, that it would make a difference if the U.S. president was out, you know, vocally supporting the protesters the way that Mitch McConnell or Lindsey Graham has done? Or is it more important to keep your eyes on, you know, this idea that there's at the same time a trade negotiation that he would like to get done?
I mean, I think it would make a difference. I think if he were out there vocally supporting the protesters, as many Americans do, it would probably send some sort of signal to these negotiations and to, you know, the president of China, that maybe the negotiations are called off. I mean, he is in a prickly situation, but, you know, he could also stand up and say, we stand for free speech and people have the right to demonstrate. And what's happening in Hong Kong, you know, clearly over a million people are organizing for a reason. And we don't want to meddle with that because, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, the United States doesn't like to meddle in other countries' politics. That would be probably the appropriate thing for him to say. But, you know, he clearly doesn't listen to his advisors.
Nomiki Konst is with us in studio. Also on the line, Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Lonnie, turning to the economy, the U.S. has been enjoying more than 10 years of economic growth. You talked a little bit about the way the China trade negotiations have been impacting consumer confidence, business confidence. There's other indicators that there might be some stormy weather moving in. The yield on the 10-year Treasury bond fell below the interest rate for the 2-year notes on Wednesday. And that's what bond traders call an inverted yield curve. I don't know how many other journalists like myself have been like rapidly studying up on inverted yield curves. It was very brief on a Wednesday, but it is an indicator that economists say often signals a future recession on the horizon. The stock market tumbled as well on Wednesday. Is the economy still President Trump's strong suit moving into 2020? Lonnie Chen.
Well, I think in some ways it's what they had banked on. I think that the Trump campaign and the president, you know, they have been talking about the strength of the economy as something that, for the president at least, is a source of strength. The problem with doing that, of course, is that there really is only so much a president can do about an economy. I mean, presidents love to claim credit for great economies, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, but the reality is that the economy moves on a business cycle and a set of things that are largely beyond the president's control. Now, there are some things like initiating a trade war with China that have not been good for the economy. But what we're seeing in terms of recession or the possibility of a recession, you know, if you look at U.S. measures, you mentioned the inverted yield curve. You also have slowdowns in key sectors like housing and manufacturing. You're seeing housing values begin to come back to earth in some areas where even the housing market's been very healthy for some time. And then you have global headwinds like none other we've seen recently. You have slow economies in China, in Europe. The UK has been a disaster because of Brexit. And so the headwinds are much stronger than we would like to see in a situation like this where the U.S. economy is already weakening. And so I think a lot of economists do feel that we're headed for a slowdown of some sort. And if that's the case, it's going to be tough for the president to continue to paint a rosy picture when the reality may be very different 6 months or a year from now.
But Lonnie, Larry Kudlow was on over the weekend of the Sunday shows saying, don't be afraid to be optimistic that, you know, there's no recession on the horizon. This was only a temporary blip. There was even an argument over whether it was a true inverted yield curve or whether it just became like a flattening of a curve for a while. And then we also had White House trade advisor Peter Navarro talking with Jake Tapper on CNN's State of the Union. And he said that tariffs on Chinese goods were not affecting consumers in the U.S.
Are consumers bearing anything on that? No. We have seen absolutely no evidence in the price data. The consumer, that's not showing up in the consumer price index. China is slashing their prices.
These tariffs aren't hurting anybody in the United States.
They're not hurting anybody here.
Then why?
Okay? They're hurting China.
So Nomiki Konst, who's in the studio with me right now, I'll throw this to you first. The president's advisors are saying, you know, don't worry. This is, you know, a tempest in a tea kettle, and indicators are strong. Unemployment is very low. That is, by some indications, driving up wages. There is, you know, most people who are looking for a job can find it right now. The growth in the economy has stayed relatively good. It's not the 3% that Trump promised, but it's over 2%. So they do have a lot to celebrate right now. I mean, do you think that that message that they're trying to put forward, that don't be afraid to be optimistic, is something that voters will listen to?
I think they're trying to keep confidence up, whether economic confidence or or for the election coming up. But the reality is, I mean, what Donald Trump was elected on, you know, very strategically, was the economic instability, was the fact that income inequality is greater than it's ever been. And it continues to grow that way. So, yes, there has been some sort of small growth. But let's not forget the jobs that people are taking are not always full time. They're working several jobs. They don't have benefits. People are, as Bernie Sanders has highlighted and Senator Warren has highlighted over and over on the campaign trail, people are going broke because they don't have access to health insurance. You know, unions are under attack. So, you know, you have to look at these things through the context of, okay, sure, in this one specific area, there is a little bit of growth. But that is the mastermind of Republican messaging, is they like to highlight on one thing and ignore 99% of the economic situation.
So you're saying people aren't feeling it?
People aren't feeling it. They're still not feeling it. You know, even in Europe, as Lonnie mentioned, you know, the economy, there is still some sort of social safety net in Europe, and people are still struggling with housing costs. Rent is higher in larger cities than it's ever been. If you want to talk about how a president could make a difference, you know, his tax cuts, which were supposed to promise this, you know, revolutionized economy, really have done nothing, and they're about to expire. They only supported the wealthiest of the wealthy in America. So, yes, the economy is doing better, but of course it's doing better for the 0.1%, the 1%, and those who are able to buy properties and not pay taxes in major cities across America.
We have to go to a quick news break, but I want to come back to this economic conversation. I want to get Lonnie Chen's take on what Nomiki Kuntz just said, that people aren't really feeling the strength of the economy right now. Again, Lonnie Chen here with us from the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and Nomiki Kuntz, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission and Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016. We're going to be back after this news break with Hedy Lyn Herdes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. And with us is our politics roundtable for a Monday. Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and Nomiki Kuntz, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission and former Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016. Nomiki just got back from Greece, where she was writing a book. So we'll just move on from that. Nobody wants to hear about that in our jealousy here. But I want to throw it back to Lonnie Chen, because Nomiki, before we went to the break, was saying that, you know, despite these indicators like low unemployment and pretty strong economic growth, over 2% in the last quarter, that people aren't feeling that in their daily lives in wages. They have to work multiple jobs. Do you think that that is going to be an issue going into 2020, the disparity between economic indicators and what people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis?
Economic anxiety as a concept is very real, and it's particularly real, more so in some parts of the country than others. I think it might be a little bit of an overstatement to say that, you know, the majority of people are feeling that way, but certainly enough people are feeling it that it will be a factor in the politics of this. And, you know, it has to do with any number of different factors, rising costs for goods that we consume, whether it's energy or other consumables. Housing prices, as she mentioned, are quite high, particularly in some urban areas. And, you know, the gains from the recent sort of economic boom, as it were, have not been evenly distributed. I think that's certainly true. The question becomes to what degree people are going to vote their pocketbooks and vote their sentiment, because, you know, the data at the macro level definitely does not tell the whole story. And I think that whoever wins the Democratic nomination is going to have to figure out a way to tell this story, which is the story of people who have felt as though, even though the economy as a whole is doing well, there are people who have been left behind. And I think the question becomes how you do that effectively, and then how does the president defend against that without looking completely out of touch? I think that's going to be a really interesting dynamic to watch in this year or next year's election.
Yeah, that balancing act for an incumbent to strike. Lonnie, the Trump administration announced it was going to delay a good chunk of those $100 billion in tariffs. A lot of consumer goods in that category, things that would be on a Christmas shopping list. And the president admitted that he decided with his advisors to delay those tariffs because things like cell phones, video game consoles, certain types of footwear, all that stuff would be expected to be under the tree or, you know, a gift for Hanukkah or what have you in the holidays. And they didn't want consumers to feel that. do you think that there's a growing understanding or a growing recognition from the Trump administration that tariffs do affect consumers?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they delayed this last round of tariffs, which was set to go into effect right in time for the holiday shopping, Christmas shopping season, is, I think, an indication that they understand that while these tariffs have not necessarily had an impact directly on price for most consumers yet, they certainly would have, particularly given the types of goods we were talking about. So everything from iPhones to consumer electronics to certain kinds of toys, the impact of the tariffs was going to be directly felt at some point down the road. Now, a lot of the big box retailers like Walmart, for example, had essentially said that they felt they could absorb a lot of that because they were essentially squeezing consumers harder, not consumers, excuse me, suppliers harder down the road, and it continuing to be able to extract, you know, relatively good prices for consumers. That having been said, that trend would not be able to last forever. So the tariffs almost certainly would have affected consumers. And I think the Trump administration's delay of those tariffs is a recognition that that was bound to happen at a very, very inconvenient time.
We could go on and on about the economy. I think it's going to be obviously the biggest issue going into 2020, up with healthcare, up with everything else. But there was this big back and forth that I want to get your take on. My guests right now on the political panel are Nomiki Konst and Lonnie Chen up at Stanford. Nomiki's in the studio with me. The conversation over whether Israel would allow two Democratic congresswomen who are part of this group nicknamed the Squad in Congress, Representative Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, into the country. The president kind of waded into this one on Twitter last week, saying that Israel would show great weakness by letting the congresswomen into the country. They had a trip planned for this week. And so at first, Israel said no because the representatives support this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And then Israel granted Tlaib the right to visit her 90-year-old grandmother in the West Bank. But Tlaib then decided she didn't want to go through with it because Israel was requiring her to place, you know, certain conditions on her ability to speak about, you know, Israeli treatment of Palestinians, et cetera. So there was this big back and forth over this. You know, the president wading in, it seemed to be, you know, right during a week where he was dealing with a big stock market sell-off, where he, you know, had a lot of other things on his plate that we've just discussed. Was this an issue of, you know, a president who's very good at controlling the news cycle misdirecting, Nomiki?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he knows how to play to his base, anger his base, and frankly, you know, pit people against each other. But take a step back for a second. These are two U.S. congresswomen. They represent our country. And the president of the United States sided with the policies of Israel over two of his own. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. You know, you're protecting your people and your representatives. That is very unusual in, if you look at the context of history. I mean, to side with another country's policies over your own representatives. You know, it should be country over party, right? So I think, yes, he's very good at and exciting his base. Clearly, his base in a very dangerous way has really gone against, especially Representative Ilhan Omar, but as well as Representative Tlaib and the whole squad. There, you know, used to be Nancy Pelosi, you know, on Fox News all day long, and Hillary Clinton. This is a Republican Party. This far right Republican Party has issue with outspoken women. And it doesn't matter if it's just on Israel or our economic policies. It is outspoken women.
Lonnie, can you jump in on this? Because I hear what Nomiki's saying, and it certainly does feel like these members of the squad have been singled out for reasons other than simply their politics. They are women. They're women of color. You know, some of them are Muslim women. Is this an issue of, you know, purely ideological differences, or does the president see a useful foil in these members of the squad?
Yeah, I mean, I think he sees a useful foil. I think he believes, and I think a lot of Republicans believe, that the more that people like Rashida Tlaib and her colleagues, her squad, as it were, are in the news, the better off Republicans are. It's a look that they don't mind running against politically. The most recent episode with Israel, look, I don't think anybody came out of this looking particularly good, to be honest with you. I think the Israelis made a mistake and miscalculated in how they handled it. I think the president came out probably much too forcefully in a lot of ways on this. And I think the two members of Congress certainly saw political opportunity and tried to play that as well. So I don't think anybody came out of this looking particularly good. But there's no question that for the president and for Republicans, being able to run against a far left agenda is going to work to, they believe, to their advantage in next year's election.
Turning the page, just because we are, here for the hour, and I want to get to as many topics as possible. California Attorney General Javier Becerra has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration over this new public charge rule that could deny green cards to immigrants who are on food stamps, Medicaid, other public assistance. People applying for green cards are already required by federal law to prove that they won't become a what's been called public charge, posing a financial burden to the United States, but this really expands a broader range of programs that could be disqualifying. Lonnie, this has brought to mind for a lot of people the poem on the Statue of Liberty, Emma Lazarus's poem, and famously members of the Trump administration, particularly Ken Cuccinelli, acting director of USCIS, has come out and sort of done his own rewrite of that poem on a few different media outlets. Is this a conversation that will help the president ultimately prove to his base that he cares about restricting immigration, which has been a major platform of his?
Yeah, I think that's right. There is a huge opportunity that the administration and the president continue to see in driving immigration as an issue. And, you know, it's interesting if you look back over the last couple of years, and there have been different kinds of policies and different things the administration has talked about, but they always do seem to return to immigration. They always do seem to return to positioning on immigration that is got a very hard edge to it, that is seen as a bright line contrast with, for example, where Democrats are. And this latest promulgation of this rule, this public charge rule, is an example of how the president wants to use immigration to drive up measure of support, not just with his base, by the way, because, you know, his base, he can pretty much do anything and that'll be fine. So I'm not talking about the 30 some odd percent of people who really will support the president regardless. What he is getting at is he's getting at this issue of economic anxiety that we talked about before, and he's trying to drive immigration to get to that issue.
So Nomiki Konst, who's in studio with me right now, I talked about Ken Cuccinelli sort of rewriting the Emma Lazarus poem, give me you're tired, you're poor, and saying, at least on CNN, that at the time she was referring to the European exodus into the United States, that these were European immigrants and that at the time they had a class system that would have made it really difficult to stay in Europe because they were discriminated against because of the class that they were in. But a lot of people took that as saying basically European immigration right. is the preferred form of immigration. Where do advocates go from here when, as Lonnie said, the issue of immigration is so mobilizing mm-hmm. to a good section of the electorate? We are just going to see more of this back and forth because it seems to serve to gin up the base on one side and maybe gather in undecideds on one side and also strike terror into a lot of people's hearts on another side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's definitely the base that may see things in a more a racist, a very extreme right base that will see things through a racist lens. And then there are folks who really are listening to this flawed economic argument that why are we giving handouts, quote, to people who are not citizens? And that is an economic argument you hear on Fox News and Fox Business and in even centrist media all day long, because that is what it's going to take for Donald Trump to tap into that economic anxiety, as Lonnie mentioned. But let's be real here. I mean, as Javier Becerra said in his statements, this is racism. This is a president who is not seeing, who's using race and in a very dangerous way, a very dangerous way. I mean, the Republican Party that Marco Rubio ran on and even and former President Bush ran on was always arguing for a path to legal citizenship. These are people who are going through the path to legal citizenship by getting their green cards. They are doing it the way that the Republican Party was advocating for just a couple of years ago. And so what Donald Trump is now doing is he's saying, no, we don't even want to give them a path anymore. It is a completely nativist approach. And Ken Cuccinelli, who, you know, is Italian, let's just be real, you know, honest, I don't even think his views reflect Donald Trump's views. I mean, at the end of the day, Donald Trump has made incredibly nativist comments even to Europeans. I mean, they've also restricted visa access for Europeans. So this isn't just a southern border immigration policy, but the United States is restricting immigration, you know, working visas, travel visas. Of course, we have the travel ban for pretty much anybody outside of the United States.
Nomiki Konst with us, former surrogate for Bernie Sanders in 2016. Lonnie Chen is also on the line, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Quick break, then we're back for a wrap-up of our politics roundtable here on Air Talk. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Back after this. Air Talk, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're going to wrap up with a quick response to the president angry at Fox News, something that an entity that's been his ally in a lot of ways, helped get him elected in 2016. He's upset because a recent Fox News poll has him losing a head-to-head matchup with Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris. Very quick response from Lonnie Chen, seeing the president criticizing Fox News in a public forum. You know, is the honeymoon over with Fox? Do you expect that to continue, or is there trouble in paradise?
Yeah, it was the honeymoon was over a little while ago, actually, between the president and Fox. You know, he has spoken about specific anchors on Fox who he doesn't like, people who are oriented toward reporting the news. And I think there are some really good journalists at Fox. And he's, you know, called out various people by name, including Chris Wallace and others. So he's been doing this for a while. And you know, the reality is that the president's trying to do what he can to influence the coverage he gets on Fox. He's doing it in a very public way. But, you know, there's always a distinction between the editorial side of a news agency and the reporting side. And so I think the president is trying to exert influence. But yeah, I think that honeymoon, particularly with certain people at Fox, is definitely over.
Nomiki Konst, your reaction. We have about a minute left here. The president has enjoyed really strong support with that network and used it as a tool to get his message out. What do you expect going forward? Do you think Fox is going to back down?
You know, anybody who's watched The Loudest Voice in the Room on Showtime or read the book knows that fair and balanced is part of the Fox shtick, right? So it's good for Fox News to show disagreement with Donald Trump. But let's pull back the layer a bit. Donald Trump's communications director, I believe, on his campaign is Bill Shine, the former executive vice president of Fox News. He has stacked pretty much his entire campaign and you know, many of the communications directors with former Fox News advisors, directors, hosts. So it's very convenient.
The connection is still tight. It's all
extremely
in the family, is what I hear you saying. Nomiki Konst joined us for our politics roundtable, former member of the DNC Unity Reform Commission and former Bernie Sanders surrogate in 2016. She's been writing a book. Look for that very soon. And Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, a former advisor on several presidential campaigns, including Romney Ryan in 2012. Lonnie, thanks, as always, for being on Air Talk.
Thank you.
More Air Talk coming up in just a couple of minutes. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Thanks for sticking with us. On 89.3 KPCC, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Today, we are going to be talking in just about a half an hour about youth sports and the decline in participation that researchers have been seeing in youth sports and what's behind that. So if you are somebody that has kids that are
thinking about joining or maybe quitting a sport, if you yourself were a kid that dropped out of sports early, tell us why. We want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-893-5722. You can write on our AirTalk page. You can also go on Twitter or Facebook. We're available on all the social media channels. No TikTok page yet, though. Maybe there will be a TikTok AirTalk page coming up pretty soon. That's it, coming up in about a half an hour here. But on August 8th, in the meantime, there was a mysterious explosion at a nuclear facility in the north of Russia. The cause has not been confirmed, and we still don't have many answers about what happened. But experts speculate this was a failed launch of a new type of weapon Russia is working on. It's a nuclear-powered cruise missile that could evade U.S. missile defense systems. This is just the latest development in what appears to be a return of certain parts of the nuclear arms race of the Cold War. And we want to look at what's been happening between the U.S. and Russia with an eye to history and the history of nuclear negotiations between these two countries. Journalist Guillaume Serena is in studio with me now. He is the author of a new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. Guillaume, thank you so much for being on Air Talk today.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
So you're also the outreach coordinator for the International School of Los Angeles. You published 5 books in French, including the first French language biography of Barack Obama. But this is your first English language book, so that's very exciting as well.
Absolutely.
So what do we know about what happened in Russia on August 8th? Was this a new kind of missile? And where does it fit in the nuclear arms race that's really been going on for half a century now?
Well, as you just said, we don't really know exactly what happened. From American sources, we know that it might have been a missile being tested and a new kind of missile, as you said, with a nuclear propulsion system. So if that's the truth, there was not a nuclear warhead on it, because obviously that would have been noticed way more. But with instead of fuel, this missile would have been propelled by nuclear, by a nuclear system. So that's what happened. We count, I think, 7 dead people. A town was evacuated, but it's still pretty unclear.
Yeah, and it's not a lot of information coming out of the Russian government. We know that President Putin presented these new types of weapons at an event in March of last year. And one of them was like an underwater weapon that could evade U.S. missile defense systems. This one would be the nuclear-powered cruise missile. If this is indeed what happened in northern Russia, since we don't know for sure, it would be something that would also fly below sort of the general arc of an intercontinental ballistic missile, and so therefore also evade missile systems. So this seems to really be directly aimed at circumventing U.S. defenses, right? I mean, this is like a major step in the way that these two countries relate in a nuclear arms race.
Well, for sure, we are in a new arms race. That's for sure, since at least a couple of years. First of all, because most of these missiles and material were obsolete for a long time, since the 80s. So both countries, actually, Russia and the United States, started to modernize, started to miniaturize, started to invent new forms of weapons. So, of course, being not detected is a huge, huge strategic importance. And what we see is truly something worrying between these two countries. We're not even talking about China, that we know is probably hiding a lot of its weapons.
Guillaume Serena joins me right now. His new book is about a historic summit that occurred in 1986 between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in Iceland, in Reykjavik. The book's called An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. You know, I want to get to the events of your book because I think that it really illustrates something important in the history of nuclear negotiations, and it teaches us so much about what's going on today. I think, first of all, though, you know, to see these new weapons being developed, to see arsenals being invested in a way that I wasn't aware of before reading your book, I always assumed, being a child during the 80s, not remembering the Cold War, that we just had this web of agreements that protected us from any kind of looming Armageddon. You know, it's not war games anymore. You know, our big threat on the world stage is terrorism. But what I'm seeing now is major world powers once again amping up their arsenals and potentially creating tension points that could lead again to the threat of nuclear war. I mean, it just seems unbelievable to me.
Right. Well, at the time in the Cold War, you had basically two huge superpowers holding about 95% of nuclear weapons, right? The United States and the Soviet Union. Today, indeed, we're dealing with a much more unstable situation on the world scale. And today we have 9 countries having nuclear weapons. And the total number of them is more than 13,000 warheads today. But at the time, it was even way more, the double. So you had these two superpowers. Of course, it was scary. But it was the time of deterrence, you know, of MAD being mutual assured destruction, right? So in a way, these two players were rational. They were holding their backs, and of course there were discussions at low levels and higher levels, like in Reykjavik in 1986. Today, I think the world is way more unstable. You know, key players are less predictable. You have, obviously, the North Korea situation. You have the South China Sea situation. You have India and Pakistan, as we see right now, as we speak. It's very, very tense in Kashmir. So the world changed. And unfortunately, in 86 in Reykjavik, we had a window to maybe get rid of all nuclear weapons, and didn't happen for one detail.
Yeah, so I want to get to that because that's the subject of your book. Stepping back in history, you know, this 1986 summit in Reykjavik, two leaders in a, you know, relatively modest house in Iceland. You know, what is the purpose of this summit? Why are Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan meeting? And what are both sides hoping to get out of this summit?
Well, first we need to remind our listeners that Gorbachev arrived in 85 in power and was pretty unknown from the rest of the world. You know, all the Soviet leaders died one after another. They were very old people. And there hadn't been a meeting between a U.S. president and a Soviet leader since 1979. So when Gorbachev takes power, Ronald Reagan just starts his second term. And there's a pretty great impatience on both sides to meet. So they meet in Geneva for the first time. They talk, they break the ice, you know, they say nice words. They start to work on some important files, but it was mostly to break the ice and to get to know each other. And the Americans actually started to feel like you can work with Gorbachev. He's different. You know, something's going on in
Moscow. He's new guard. He's a new, different generation.
And he's much younger. He's only 55 at the time. Absolutely. And in the spring of 1986, you had a couple of things happening really important in the Soviet Union. First of it was, of course, the explosion in Chernobyl in Soviet Ukraine, that huge nuclear disaster. There was also the Danilov case, which is like a spy story, like we read in the Cold War books. And that triggers Gorbachev, and he decides to write a letter to Reagan asking for a pre-summit. They had agreed to meet in 87, whether in Moscow and Washington, but he wants to see Reagan again, and he wants to talk more.
Because there were these events that you mentioned, Chernobyl and an exchange of an alleged spy, the Danilov incident. These things were heating up the tensions between the countries,
right.
And so Gorbachev is wanting to move up this summit to meet sooner than expected.
Exactly. But also Gorbachev, he's scared of the American Strategic Defense Initiative, which is the Star Wars, as the media called it at the time. So Reagan has been pushing that program publicly since 1983. And after Chernobyl, after realizing the lack of modernity in the nuclear system in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev wants to precipitate, to rush nuclear discussions, wanting to decrease arsenals in both countries, yes.
Because Star Wars, when Reagan announced it, you know, it was this fantastic idea of satellites that would use lasers to shoot missiles out of the sky. A lot of people laughed, but the Russian government, the Soviet Union government, was not laughing. I mean, this was something that they were taking seriously as an escalation. If the U.S. had no fear of their weapons anymore, mutually assured destruction was no longer in effect. And so the predictability of this bipolar model of the Cold War was going to go out the window, right?
That's right. And the Americans presented SDI as a defense system. But of course, the Soviets saw it as an offensive, potential offensive weapon system. If you can send a laser from space on a missile in flight, well, obviously you can also attack, right? So indeed, I mean, it was taken really, really seriously by the Soviets. Here in the United States, it was pretty controversial. Like the scientific community at the time, if you read the press of the time, or even the memos that President Reagan had inside the White House, the scientific community, the allies of the United States, all Western Europe were against it. Maybe not Maggie Thatcher, but most of the other ones says, you can't arm the space. You're going one step further. So Gorbachev understood that and felt that SDI was a danger for the Soviet Union. That's why he wanted to talk about it.
So he is pushing up this summit. Gorbachev is between the U.S. president and himself. They arrive in October of 86 in Iceland. The two camps are, you know, meeting in a home. It's not really big enough for the two groups, you know. And I just really want to quickly recommend that people read about this scene in your book, An Impossible Dream: Reagan, Gorbachev, and a World Without the Bomb. I'm speaking with Guillaume Serena, journalist and author of this book about this historic summit between the U.S. president and Mikhail Gorbachev, because, you know, it's kind of unbelievable that, you know, a delegation sent from the U.S. and from the Soviet Union to negotiate the balance of world power and the future of the safety of humanity, they're meeting in sort of this, you know, inappropriately small space where they're sort of having to sit in the hallway to, like, write memos. And it's a kind of a funny situation. So a great scene in your book. They arrive at the house, you know, very rapidly. I think President Reagan is surprised at how far Mikhail Gorbachev is willing to go in terms of getting rid of the nuclear arsenal of both countries.
Right. So it happens on 2 days. And the first day, indeed, Reagan and his advisors are prepared to talk about a series of issues, such as human rights, such as Afghanistan and other Cold War spots, and of course, nuclear arsenals. But the Soviets come in to Reykjavik really with one thing in mind, which is the arms race and dealing with nuclear weapons. So on their first conversation there, and I have to add that the press, the media, there's a blackout. They really don't know in detail what's going to happen. Of course, they know the two leaders will talk, but they don't know really the topics. And during that first conversation, they agree that, I quote, a nuclear war cannot be won and shall not be started. So both presidents share that. And, you know, today it sounds normal, but at the time it was pretty bold to say that. So indeed, Gorbachev on that first afternoon is pretty aggressive. He's talking extremely directly to Reagan. He knows everything. He knows even some technical issues about nuclear missiles. He has a list of nuclear weapons and missiles category by category. And they seem much more prepared. And from the research I did and seeing the Soviet archives, we now know that Gorbachev had a blank check from the Politburo in Moscow to go as far as he wanted in order to get rid of the maximum nuclear weapons in exchange of getting rid of the SDI. So the Americans are pretty, on that first day, destabilized a little bit. But they do agree on that first day that there should be a huge reduction, 50%, in intermediate range missiles, which after that led to the INF Treaty, signed in 87 that we heard about in the news this last few weeks.
And so those are the missiles that are placed in Europe
and
that
Asia.
Can go, yeah. You know, they're not going out of, you know, across
the globe. It's not intercontinental.
Right. Exactly. It's just a shorter range missile. We're going to be back with Guillaume Serena, author of the new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and A World Without the Bomb. He's taking us to this summit in 1986 between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan, when the two leaders came extremely close to eliminating nuclear arsenals. Some of their work developed into treaties that later laid the framework for, you know, really putting the Cold War behind us, or at least, you know, a lot of people maybe assumed that it was. Now there's been a number of developments in recent weeks and the past year or so, you know, nuclear arsenals being built back up again by Russia, the U.S. and China. We're going to talk about it all coming back. I'm Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle, back after this short break on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KBCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Larry's feeling just a little under the weather, so he's taking the day off. Happy to be here with you. In studio with me is Guillaume Serena, a journalist and author of the new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and a World Without the Bomb. And Guillaume, we're in this summit in a house in Reykjavik in Iceland. The first day has gone by, and the Americans, President Reagan, is surprised by how far Mikhail Gorbachev wants to go to eliminate nuclear stockpiles. But they are very focused, the Soviet group, on also eliminating the Star Wars project that was nowhere near actually being functional, but something that was in development that the U.S. had touted and that the Soviets were very afraid of. Ultimately, what happens the next day? What becomes the sticking point that they just cannot overcome?
Right. So during the night, both groups negotiate and get technical and try to put some things on paper about what was discussed on the first day. But indeed, that second day is getting extremely dramatic. You can feel the tension in the room when you read the conversations. You have Reagan with Schultz, the Secretary of State. You have Gorbachev and Shevardnadze. You have note takers and translators, obviously. And here that morning, Gorbachev goes, you know, put all his cards on the table, and he says, "Look, why don't we get rid of all nuclear weapons? Each category, including intercontinental missiles. And why don't we do this in 10 years? And within these 10 years, you guys can research and develop the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars." So indeed, the Americans are pretty surprised of such a bold move from Gorbachev. And you can feel that the American side is pretty divided.
Yeah, how does Reagan respond to that kind of an offer? He in his heart, it wants to reduce nuclear stockpiles. Mm-hmm. That was something he was vocal about.
He was vocal about even from way before being elected president. It's really something that he cares about. He hates nuclear weapons. So on that, they do agree, you know, and these two people actually get along. But during that afternoon, you can feel the tension. You can feel the emotion. You can feel sometimes they get carried away. They yell at each other. Sometimes they have tears in their eyes. So on the American side, Reagan seems exhausted on that last afternoon. Schultz is pushing. You can see it when he intervenes in the conversation. He tells Gorbachev, "Wait a second. Are you saying that you want to get rid of all nuclear weapons?" And he's pushing for a deal. He's pushing Reagan for a deal. In the other room, all the people from the defense department are telling Reagan, "Don't strike a deal. We can't trust. This is the Soviet Union." There's a distrust factor from the other side too, as well. To be honest, so the tension will arise about the reserve and development of the SDI. And Reagan says, "I promised it to the American people. You know, 3 weeks from now, there's the midterm elections. So that must have been in his head. He says we need to research and develop it. And 10 years, you know, we want to be able to develop that in space. And what Gorbachev is proposing is actually research and development in the laboratory.
And that's such a sticking point.
And that's the key word.
The laboratory. What does a laboratory mean? You know, there's conversations about, especially later, you know, a laboratory can mean many things. But at the time, in that conversation in Reykjavik, mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, they would only be able to test in a lab and not, you know, elsewhere outside, you know, I guess in the world.
Exactly.
That was the sticking point for Americans.
Well, at the point, and still today, 33 years later, that's a technology that doesn't exist. So 10 years was, you know, to give time for something that's extremely complicated. I mean, imagine putting lasers on satellites, how much it costs, how complicated it is technically, in terms of maintenance as well. Today, we're still not doing it. So that's the dramatic and the irony of that history is that they didn't strike a deal. Maybe today we would live in a nuclear bomb-free world because of a technology that didn't even exist and still doesn't exist.
But as you suggest in your book, Star Wars was, you know, one more chip on this pile of spending and escalation and proof that the United States would financially be able to bury the Soviet Union eventually. I mean, the truth of what was happening mm-hmm. behind or below the surface, below the PR by the Soviets was the economy was not going to be able to sustain the arms race.
Right. But that was only one of the bets, one of the factors. I know today a lot of people and the American literature says, oh, that was a total goal and a will to outspend the Soviet Union. It's more complicated than that. Indeed, that was one of the strategy. And we know that today some people in Washington, in the State Department and Defense Department, was aiming to that. We now have the proof. But it was a very risky poker play, right? And as we know now, the dislocation, the destruction from the inside of the Soviet Union had multiple factors, including a lot of inside factors, whether political, economical, even ethnical. So it's complicated.
It is complicated. Isn't that always the case with history? We're speaking with Guillaume Serena, the author of a new book, An Impossible Dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and a World Without the Bomb. What comes out of Reykjavik? The talks fall apart. The agreement to actually reduce or remove all nuclear warheads is not reached. But there are some concrete agreements that eventually come from these talks, right?
Sure.
And tell me about those, and then we can connect them to today.
Sure. Well, first, it's true, it's a huge missed opportunity. That was probably the only window, and that was Gorbachev was telling Reagan. You know, we were not that close to be able to do that before, and you don't know who's going to succeed me and what's going to happen. So let's do it. We have a narrow window. And indeed, the history tells us that it never happened again. Right. So at least you had a deal that became the INF Treaty, which is the intermediate range missiles that both the United States and Russia withdrawn a couple of months ago today. Then it also led to the first START Treaty in 1988 that was signed between Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush, Reagan's successor. Today, we're under a treaty which would be START number 4. It's called New START that was signed in 2010, which needs to be renewed in February 2021. But we don't know where we stand. We don't know what's going on right now. We don't know if it's going to be sustained.
And just lay the groundwork. START is addressing actual numbers of warheads, whereas the INF treaty was focused on this one type of, you know, ranged, the short-range warheads,
correct.
Right?
The R in START stands for reduction. So we are reducing the numbers. And obviously it's under that expression, trust and verify, meaning you have American agents on Russian soil making sure they do dismantle all these missiles and weapons. And the same, you have Russian people coming on U.S. soil to do the same.
And as you mentioned earlier, this framework of agreements between the U.S. and what became, you know, Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, it did succeed in reducing stockpiles significantly. The numbers are still huge. The numbers are mind-boggling, but it still has reduced them significantly. Why did the INF collapse? Why did these countries pull out earlier this month? And why is START kind of on shaky ground? Are both countries just sort of deciding we want to amp up our warhead game? We want to, you know, invest, and we are interested in an arms race again.
Mm-hmm. Well, both countries accused each other of not respecting the treaty. So that's why the Trump administration decided to do that. And in reaction, the Russians did the same. Yes, these treaties worked. You know, in the 80s, the number of nuclear warheads were three times larger. But why is it important that we have these kind of agreements and that the new START is prolonged? Is that today we have 9 countries with nuclear weapons. Okay, Reykjavik gives us a frame of how this negotiation could happen. You know, still Russia and the United States hold 90% of today's world's arsenal. So first they need to start talking again, right? Then we can imagine a system, an international conference that could be, for example, based on the model of the climate agreement that every country in the world signed in Paris a few years ago. Actually, today, there is a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons that was signed inside the United Nations in July 2017. You had 70 countries who signed to ban nuclear weapons, 25 of them ratified. So that gives a frame. Of course, all the nuclear countries declined to do so, of course, being ironic. But saying, you know, let's have an international law treaty that gives us a frame so we can discuss these issues.
I can't help but think about the motivations of a country to decide if they are, you know, capable, they have weapons development systems and scientific communities that are capable of developing nuclear weapons. When they look at the way different countries have been treated on the world stage before and after they develop nuclear weapons. And I'm thinking first and foremost about North Korea and Iran, mm-hmm. the different cases there. You know, Iran has been close to, you know, within striking distance of developing nuclear weapons for some time now. They had agreed to a framework of conditions, you know, under, you know, a recent agreement that the Trump administration decided to pull out of, the rest of the world is still in. But when Iran looks at the way that North Korea, after developing nuclear weapons, is suddenly a country where the U.S. president is visiting and sitting down with its leader, even though this is an isolated country accused of many human rights violations, achieving a nuclear weapon has meant legitimacy for the North Korean, you know, dictator and the North Korean regime.
Right.
Why does a country who is on unstable footing and maybe isolated from the world decide to not push forward in a framework that we're seeing right now?
It's true. It's a bargaining chip, right? North Korea is using its nuclear program to have sanctions lifted and to enter the world stage. So in that view, it's a success for Chairman Kim of North Korea. To be able to talk with the American president was something unexpected and that he probably dreamed of for a long time. But you have to have a solid agenda. You have to have preparations that last for weeks and months. In my book, I talk about the preparation of Reykjavik. It's incredible how meticulous this is. You know, it's not just for a follow-up.
Diplomacy. It takes a lot of work ahead of time.
That's correct. Now, Iran, we did have a deal. And if I mind remind our listeners, it wasn't just a deal between the United States and Iran, right? It was a deal with the United Nations, with China, with Russia, and the European Union involved.
So that's the kind of model you're talking about.
Yeah, that took 10 years to accomplish. And, you know, and according to most experts on the planet, it was working. So we do have models, you know, we know how to do it. But it seems like we're in a different era with different objectives and with leaders today that are aiming for other things.
Guillaume Serena joined me here this hour on Air Talk. An impossible dream, Reagan, Gorbachev, and a world without the bomb. I promise the book is more hopeful than the note that we just left the interview on. These issues are just so important. And I thank you so much, Guillaume, for being a part of this conversation today.
Thank you.
Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Coming up after the news break, we're going to talk about youth sports and participation in youth sports declining over the last decade or so. And what's behind that? If you are somebody who participated in youth sports and faced issues with the cost or stress associated with the sport, various obstacles that might have made you drop out, give us a call, 866-893-5722. Or maybe your coach was overbearing or your parents were pushing too hard. Maybe you yourself are a parent that pushes a little too hard. 866-893-5722. Conversation about youth sports coming up after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Rolls along here on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Denkman here for Larry Mantle. Larry's just taking a sick day. He'll be hopefully back tomorrow. The share of kids playing organized team sports has declined in recent years. Only 38% of young children played team sports regularly in 2018, compared to 45% about a decade ago, according to research from the Sports and Fitness Industry Association. And a new survey looked into the reason fewer kids are playing team sports these days. The answer is a bit of a bummer. It's just not fun. And for many kids, there's too much stress involved with organized sports. If you're like me, you look back at the time that you spent playing a sport. Like for me, it was soccer, softball, volleyball, and you have fond memories of that. But it's not the reality that a lot of kids are experiencing today, according to this survey. There is stress involved, and that leads to things just not being as fun as they should be. So let's have a conversation about that. Give us a call at 866-893-5722. Is your kid struggling to find the fun in youth sports? Are there costs that are becoming a burden to be a part of those teams, especially the traveling teams? What other challenges have you faced, either yourself participating or your child? Join the conversation, 866-893-5722, also on our AirTalk page on kpcc.org. And here to talk about the research and why we're seeing a decline in youth sports participation, Travis Dorsch is with us, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies and founder director of the Families in Sport Lab at Utah State University. He's the author of the Utah State University and Aspen Institute survey that I was referring to there in the introduction. Travis Dorsch, thanks very much for being on Air Talk. Welcome.
I appreciate you having me.
So what did your survey set out to look at, and what did you find?
Yeah, really our goal was to better understand by way of a national survey of youth sport parents why kids are playing, and maybe more importantly, why they're discontinuing sport participation on the back end of their youth sport journey. And we dove into a lot of topics, from how much money the families are spending to who the sources of pressure are, which I heard you talk about there in the opener, as well as some of the other things that relate to how coaches might be better trained, how parents might be better informed about how to parent effectively in youth sports. So really just a lot of these sort of ancillary things that surround the young athlete in sport. We're trying to really get a beat on why it is kids are enjoying sport and why it is they're saying no to sport after such a short period of time in their childhood.
And were there certain people in a kid's life that were more likely to be putting pressure on them or making things unfun when it came to sports?
Yeah, it was interesting, in this research, particularly because parents were the ones answering the survey, coaches came out as the number one source of pressure on young people. Parents rated themselves as a relatively high source of pressure as well, which tells us that maybe there's more to the story. Maybe if we were to, in fact, ask the children themselves or in a reverse sort of a way, ask the coaches, that it might in fact be the parents who are the highest source of pressure. There is research out there that talks a lot about various sources of pressure, from internalized pressure that athletes feel, they place on themselves, to these external adults, coaches, and parents, and also sometimes from peers and teammates. So I think it's really, we have to look at this through sort of a systemic lens. It's not just, you know, the parent-child relationship. It's not just the coaches, but it's really everybody and everything that surrounds the young athlete.
Lorena in Glendale wrote in to I think it was the AirTalk page. Lorena says some parents are very aggressive and it can be alienating for children and other parents too. I think that is actually a factor in, you know, parents getting more involved in the sport, for example, as a volunteer or a coach, that the other parents are really the thing that drives people away. And that's what I hear you saying, Travis Dorsch with Utah State University. I think that, you know, coaches being a source of the stress really surprises me quite a bit, but parents potentially also part of that. What about cost? You looked at prices, right, and what people are paying out of pocket for these sports and how that affects things?
Yeah, and it's really a huge range, as you might expect, just like there's a huge range in what people earn here in America. There's a huge range on what families report spending. Now, you know, the mean number here is about $690, so just under $700 per child, per season, per sport. It might not seem like a lot, but when you sort of take a step back and look at this from the 40,000 foot level, we see that parents are spending anywhere from zero to in upwards of $30,000. Again, one child, one season, one sport. Now, that high number, $30,000, is a bit mind-blowing. And when you think about what we sort of expect on the back end of that, right, if we think about this as an investment in our children's future, what do we expect on the back end of that investment? Are we expecting, you know, them to start in high school, for them to earn a college scholarship, for them potentially to play professionally, or are we just out there for them to have a good time and to learn life lessons and to enjoy their experience? And I think that's the question that really, you know, when I talk to parents, I try and get across to them is, you know, what are your goals for your child, and do your goals align with their goals? And in many cases, I think the answer is no, and it's not because, you know, because parents don't want to have the same goals. It's because oftentimes they don't have the conversation with their young person at home and say, hey, what is it that you want to get from this? And how can I help you as your parent?
Yeah, that is such an important conversation that I can't imagine is as common as it should be out there. Travis Dorsch with the Utah State University Families and Sport Lab. Also joining the conversation is Jay Coakley, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, where his primary research interest is youth sports. And he's the author of Sports and Society, Issues and Controversies. Professor Coakley, thanks for being on Air Talk. And when you look at research like what Travis Dorsch has just been presenting, and you see issues like cost, issues like overbearing coaches being a part of why kids quit, does that surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't. It's part of a general trend that's been going on for about 30 years now. Started in the late 80s, and it has become increasingly prevalent up to the present. So the whole structure of youth sports has changed, and it has affected the way young people look at their participation.
I'm getting a note from Matthew in Silver Lake who wrote in to say, I think the decline has to do with a lot of people playing more video games than before. It's something my friends and I have talked about, and that's the experience I've had. It's why I stopped playing football. That's Matthew in Silver Lake. Is that an issue, just having more demands on the kid's time, Professor Coakley, more options for what the kid wants to do, first of all, and also more demands from, you know, an ever-expanding list of school responsibilities, et cetera, just lack of time?
Well, definitely. And children do have a number of opportunities and pressures to engage with their schoolwork and do other things that parents think are developmentally appropriate for the kids. So what has happened as that's occurred is that kids don't have any time to themselves to engage in outdoor discretionary play and informal games. And the video game issue is an interesting one. There is a connection between playing video games and dropping out of sports, but some of the research suggests that kids are attracted to the video games more than they are to sports, because the sports have changed in ways that have led kids to think that they've lost control over their participation. And their participation in video games is all under their control.
That's a really interesting point. The control over participation is so important, especially to kids that are experiencing different types of unpredictability in their lives. Jay Coakley with the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and Travis Dorsch with us from Utah State University. We're talking about the decline in youth sports participation, which, as Jay Coakley pointed out, has been going on since the 80s, accelerated in the last 10 years. We've got calls on the line from you. If you want to join the conversation, 866-893-5722. We're going to get to Mark in Glassell Park right after this very short break. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're talking youth sports participation and why it has been declining in recent years. Really interesting comment from Maria, who is writing in from Glendale. She says, it's not only cost, it's just no longer fun. There's so much pressure to be a winning team, and other children who aren't as capable get benched and they don't get a chance to play. My child hated it because he didn't get to play. Maria, thanks very much for writing in. I think that speaks to the issue of coaches and coaches being overbearing or overly competitive. And, you know, Jay Coakley, when you hear about something like that, it just strikes me that we're really talking about, by and large, recreational youth sports. This is not to, you know, develop an Olympic athlete or mostly college athletes, right? I mean, is it appropriate for youth coaches to be benching kids interminably because they're not contributing to a team's winning record?
You know, well, there are still a few recreational programs around, but we've got to understand that most of those publicly funded programs are gone, and youth sports has become increasingly privatized, and the people who run them depend on them for their income. So definitely the coaches and the people who have organized these leagues and travel clubs and so on are much more concerned with winning because their income, their family well-being depends on it. And so they have created 12-month-a-year programs. They advertise excellence and a performance ethic being emphasized in their program, and to attract parents, because parents want to get their money's worth if they're involved in a pay-to-play kind of a system. And all of a sudden, kids are forgotten, and it's the goals of adults that are taking priority, and the kids understand this, and they're dropping out.
Yeah, it's just not accessible. If you have to be on a traveling team, on a select program, if you just want to play a casual sport to get out and get some exercise and have fun, meet some friends, as a child, you don't want all that stress. And I can see why they would avoid that, you know, especially for kids. Mark in Glassell Park is on the line. Mark, your daughter plays softball. What's her experience so far with youth sports?
Her experience is, when she started at nine, the coaches were pretty demanding and, you know, a lot of hollering and yelling at mistakes that were made by inexperienced players. And
at age nine, hollering and yelling at mistakes.
Yes. And I let her finish that season with this particular coach, and we went to a new coach, and we kind of got the same, basically the same type of experience with the other coaches. So I took time to find a coach who I like from a separate location. And, you know, we're very happy with him. In fact, she's 12 now, and we've been with him for a year. And, you know, he's very nurturing and serious at the same time. And I noticed that the girls respond well to that. And, you know, his encouragement has built a pretty strong team.
What position does your daughter play, Mark?
Well, she plays, she's a pitcher right now, but, she does do some infield.
Ooh, that's a stressful position to be in. A father of a pitcher. I've seen that play out. It's a lot of stress in the stands, but it sounds like you guys found a really good situation. I'm so glad to hear it, Mark. Thank you very much Mark and Glisselle Park. And I think that's so key that Mark had the time and the wherewithal to go through that process of finding the right person for his daughter. But so many parents just don't have those resources or the time to do that. Tori is calling in from San Marino. Tori, your kids left sports, two of them. Why?
Well, it wasn't the only reason, but the cheating just sort of sucked the air out of the joy. And so when they discovered video games, you can't cheat. I mean, the games are coded such that you can't cheat. And also when you're in some of these multiplayer online virtual games, if your behavior gets bad, you know, language devolves or you act really unsportsmanlike, the community of players will kick you out. So not only can you not cheat, but there's just kind of good community policing in a lot of the games they enjoy.
Yeah, Tori in San Marino, thank you very much. That's such an interesting element of it. The fairness aspect that ultimately comes down, you know, when you're working within a coded system like a video game, I never thought about the difference between that and kind of being out on the on a pickup soccer field or basketball field or whatever. Daniel in Irvine is on the line. Daniel, what did you want to say? You're saying it's not only sports that kids are feeling overloaded about.
Yeah, I don't think it's just sports. You know, I have a four-year-old who does some activities, but, you know, I think there's a lot of parental pressures that, you know, you see everyone else's kid doing. I'll give one example. One of my friends, their kid, she does a cooking class, a dance class, a taekwondo class, a foreign language class, and a math class, like all on the side for other schooling stuff. So I think, and then, you know, I think one of your speakers said earlier, it's in preparation for maybe this will help her for college or maybe this will become more well-rounded. But I think it's almost not just sports, but, you know, an activity overload.
Yeah, absolutely. And the expectation that that's needed to get into a good college and then that'll get you on track for life. And that kind of expectation setting for kids and that kind of stress that the culture creates now, it can definitely overwhelm and it can definitely make you want to walk away from stuff. Daniel and Irvine, thank you very much. By the way, I know it's a basketball court, not a basketball field. Let's just move on from that. Jay Coakley on the line with me still. It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. And just final thoughts, Jay, after you heard these folks who called in about what their kids were experiencing. Gosh, the video game poll seems very strong, and the changing nature of youth sports away from the public model towards the private model, both of those factors seem to be things that deserve a lot more examination.
Definitely, and I think one of the reasons that the video games are so attractive is that the people who create those games have done focus groups. They've worked with kids. They understand where kids are coming from, and they have figured out how to keep them involved in a game. And we haven't done that with youth sports. We just assume that sports are wonderful, all kids want to play them, and we haven't done the kinds of research that Travis is starting to do and other people to find out what is it that we can do to change youth sports.
Yeah, and to make them more appropriate for what we know about psychology nowadays. I mean, not everything has to be exactly the same as it was for our parents' generation or for our generation. Jay Coakley, thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk. Also, Travis Dorsch with the Utah State University. Jay Coakley is with University of Colorado. Libby Denkman in for Larry on Air Talk. Thanks so much for listening. Air Talk, Fresh Air is next.